Blog Talk Radio.
Out of Touch Radio. Touch Radio. With your host, Bill Maupin.
We are alternative radio with a twist on subject matter that really does matter.
Join us on our website at www.outoftouchradio.com. Our call-in number is 646-716-4228. Our guest today, nuclear physicist, lecturer, and author, Stanton Friedman, and UFO investigator, researcher, and writer, Ms. Kathleen Marden. We will be discussing their two books, Science Was Wrong and Captured, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. So get ready. This is going to be an incredible show. My little friends want to say hello.
What's the one? That ear see the show is the air lost the ear.
All right. Welcome to Out of Touch Radio. Today is Monday, August the 2nd of 2010, and I'm your host, Bill Maupin. And tonight is probably our most important show in our 6 months of existence. The father of ufology, Stanton Friedman, and UFO researcher, author, and niece to Betty and Barney Hill, will be joining us shortly. What's going on? Well, the website is up and running, still got a little bit of work to do, but you can listen to all of our past shows for free, and you can't beat that price. However, we do ask that you support our show by purchasing our guests' books, DVDs, or products, or attending their seminars. Gina Krizel is due for a Pocketful of Insight, which we will be continuing probably starting next week. But right now, Stanton Friedman became interested in UFOs in 1958, and since 1967, has lectured about them at more than 600 colleges and 100 professional groups in 50 U.S. states, 9 Canadian provinces, and 16 other countries, in addition to various nuclear consulting efforts. He has published more than 90 UFO papers and has appeared on hundreds of radio and TV programs, including on Larry King in 2007 and twice in 2008, and many documentaries. Kathleen Marden left her job in 1990 to pursue a career as a UFO investigator, researcher, and writer. She taught adult education classes on UFO and abduction history, and for 10 years volunteered as the Mutual UFO Network's director of field investigator training. In 2003, MUFON publicly recognized Kathy for her most outstanding contribution of advancing scientific study of the UFO phenomenon by dedicating MUFON UFO proceedings to her. Let's give a great big welcome to Stanton Friedman and Kathleen Marden. Hello, guys.
Hi.
Hello.
I want to thank you guys for joining us and talking about your two books. And Stanton, I'd like to start off with you. Just as of today, I was reading your article in the UFO magazine about SETI.
Oh, which of my nasty, noisy articles were you reading?
Well, let's see. You said that SETI stood for Silly
Effort?
Something.
Silly effort to investigate. S-E-T-R.
Correct. But what I wanted to say was, you know, has any of their, I mean, because it sounded like a really good idea at the time to do that when they did do it. But do you see any of the efforts that they've promoted as some contribution to ufology?
No, I see it as a contribution to radio telescope technology, and that's okay. And it's a contribution to supporting the people who work in the field. They need jobs too, after all. But when it comes to a scientific approach to searching for extraterrestrial intelligence, it misses the mark. First of all, it totally ignores the only data we have, the UFO data, about aliens. They're coming here. We have observations. We have physical trace cases. We have abductions. We have government cover-ups. There's an enormous amount of evidence there. They never, ever consider that evidence. Some of them will say there is no evidence, but Dr. Seth Shostak, for example, who was with the SETI Institute, a bright guy, we met on the Queen Elizabeth II. We each gave three lectures. We each listened politely. In the course of mine, I reviewed five large-scale scientific studies and said what was in them, showed slides, et cetera, and then asked how many people here have read this. He didn't raise his hand for any of the five. So, and that's true with Dr. Jill Tarter. She says there is no evidence. Where is the mention of, say, the dozen PhD theses that have been done about UFOs, or the five large-scale scientific studies, or the hundreds of papers that have been presented by professional people at the MUFON Symposia? There have been now 41 of them. Kathy and I just gave papers a little over a week ago, and they're proceeding every year. There's plenty of data, but they choose to ignore it. And that's reprehensible as far as I'm concerned. As a scientist, I mean, I worked in industry for 14 years. Now, of course, to the SETI people, if you don't work in academia, you're not a scientist, but that's a bunch of baloney. An awful lot of important work has been done outside universities. And
absolutely.
The kicker is that their initial assumptions are faulty. They assume, first of all, nobody's coming here. They assume that somebody is sending signals for some unknown reason using technology appropriate to our technology, even though we've only had radio for roughly 100 years, 110 or so.
Sure.
Why would anybody do that? How do they know what our technology level is if they haven't been coming here? And if they've been coming here, who wants to listen for signals? They assume that there's no interstellar travel. There's no colonization, no migration, Dr. Frank.
So what I was going to ask you, my question is, I think I know the answer. Should scrap it or modify it?
Well, you might try modifying it. It'll keep these guys in jobs for a while, and that's okay. I mean, they're nice, smart people, but in terms of finding extraterrestrial intelligence. Remember, their approach doesn't do it. If they pick up a signal from someplace 500 light years away, how do you know that there's a civilization there anymore? They could have planted a device to send out signals, and it could be long gone. You see, they're very pessimistic about how many societies, if you will, capable of transmitting signals to us there are in the galaxy. Frank Drake says, wow, there might be as many as 10,000. That means 1 in 10 million. The rest aren't sending signals. That would mean about 2 within 1,000 light years of here. That's a pretty empty place. Why would any of them send signals to us? Jill Tarter has said that when we finally make contact, it will help us solve our problems. There might be somebody as close as 1,000 light years. I can just see the dialogue. Hey, you guys, we need some help. Can you join with us? 2,000 years later, hey, yeah, what can we do for you? What do you need? And it's another 2,000 years before you get the message back. Does that make any sense? I don't think
right.
so. And also, I should add a couple of numbers in here. Within 55 light years of here, there are almost 2,000 stars. Not 2, not 20, about 2,000, and at least 5% say 100 of those, are sun-like stars. Now, why are we worried about stars across the galaxy? And some astronomers will tell you, look how much energy it would take to get to Andromeda. It's 2 million light years away. What do I care? You know, right. If I need a loaf of bread for dinner, I'm not going to tell my wife, I'll be back next week. There's that great bakery down in Sydney, Australia. She said, we need something for dinner. It's a mile and a half away. Go get us a loaf of bread. You know, it's utterly silly to talk about way out there. It's exciting, and you'll keep your job for a long time, but what's the point? It's not science.
Right. Yeah, I understand. Stanton, you've taken a step in a different direction of what science was wrong. You've opened many minds of the educational community to the subject of ufology. How did you and Kathy hook up for this wonderful book? By the way, you can visit our website, www.outoftouchradio.com, and there's a link there where you can purchase this book. And I highly suggest you purchase it.
And you can get to our websites, too, I suppose. Mine is www.stantonfriedman.com. Kathy, why don't you tell them yours?
Okay, mine is www.kathleen, with a K, hyphen Marden, M-A-R-D-E-N, .com.
Pretty easy. Pretty straightforward.
And there are links to their websites at our homepage. Okay, so tell us how you guys hooked up for this book.
Well, Kathy, why don't you start that after all?
Okay. Well, Stan and I had worked together on Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO experience, and we found that we worked well together. I enjoyed bouncing ideas off from Stan and having him critique my work, and I did the same thing for him, and we ended up having a very successful book. And so we started a couple of years later talking about doing another one. Stan had thought of the idea of writing the book Science Was Wrong. He had a different name for it then. It started out as But That's Impossible, Isn't It? And but then our publisher changed it to Science Was Wrong. They have the right to do that. And so we started to discuss doing a book together. And in the end, he chose 7 topics for 7 different chapters, and I chose 7. And we worked together very successfully to do that. It's always important when you're writing with somebody to know that they're going to meet the publisher's deadline. There can be consequences to not doing that. And I knew in working with Stan that he would meet his deadlines, and he knew that I would as well. And so it ended up being a very successful and enjoyable project.
Well, and I should point out that we had already talked about some of the things, the fact that some, the arguments against UFOs, you can't get here from there. Was one a major one. But this was expressed by people who knew nothing at all about travel to the stars. I worked on fission nuclear rockets, fusion nuclear rockets, and as I started to look around, I found all these examples of the impossibilist standing in the way of progress, not just in technology, but as Kathy described so well, in medical stuff, where the consequence of letting them interfere with the progress was death. Lots of people died because the powers that be said, no, you can't do things that way. That's ridiculous. That's not the way we do it. I'll let that ring and I'll move away farther. And so it became very important to us that we look around in lots of directions, not just UFOs, and we found we're even talking about the possibility of, you know, maybe another book called "And More Science Was Wrong" or "Science Was Wrong Too," because We haven't exhausted all the examples, as I'm sure you're aware. There are smart people who say stupid things, and it hasn't stopped.
You wouldn't be referring to, like, the BP oils debacle, huh?
Well, that's an example, yes, of very smart people who didn't think about what they were saying and stuck their necks out, and they got them chopped off. Yeah, it's deeper than that, though. It's people posing as authorities in areas where they really don't know anything. One of the ones I point out in the book is when the Astronomer Royal says space travel is utter bilge. Nobody will ever spend the money to do that, and what good would it do anyway? Much more important to spend money on better astronomical equipment. That was a year before Sputnik. And as a matter of fact, astronomy is a science that has benefited the most from the space program. He was the Astronomer Royal. You'd think he'd do some thinking about it. He didn't. Another astronomer, I'm dead on astronomers, boy, I'll tell you, in 1903 made a strong statement to the effect that if there's one fact he could be sure of, men would never fly any distance in a machine. And that was 2 months before the Wright brothers' first flight. Now, what did he know about flight? Nothing. Yeah, sure, the Wright brothers didn't have PhDs, but they had wind tunnels. They did all kinds of testing before they put their machine out there. They were careful workers. And part of the problem here, and it's showed up in a couple of ways in the last couple of months to me, is that the academic community seems to think that research only goes on in academia. And that's nonsense. You know, look at the stealth fighter. That was done by Lockheed, not at some university.
Sure.
And they don't understand how much work goes on out there. When I was working on nuclear airplanes, way back in 1958, which seems forever ago, at General Electric Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Department near Cincinnati, we spent $100 million in 1958, employed 3,500 people full-time, 1,100 of them were engineers and scientists. We're not talking about 10 professors and 30 grad students. We're talking about a massive effort, and $100 million was a lot of money in 1958. It may not seem like much now, but it was then. So one of the problems, and it came up the other day, somebody said if Roswell had happened, the scientists would have had to leave all these academic institutions to go and work on it. And I said, what? During the war, the United States spent literally billions of dollars establishing a whole host of outstanding laboratories, mostly for the Manhattan Project. But these are big, major, important labs like Oak Ridge National Laboratory, like Los Alamos, like Sandia, like Hanford, like Lawrence Livermore. Major labs, the three nuclear weapons labs together employ each more than 8,000 each. And their total budget is over $3 billion, which is more than all the National Science Foundation expenditures on all of its research and development programs. So, you know, I stand outside academia. I've spoken at 600 colleges, but when I listen to some of the things these guys say, it's no wonder that I get pushed in the direction of let's point out the idiocy of the nasty, noisy negativists. That's what I say when I'm being polite, you understand.
Sure. Kathy?
Yes.
Can we talk about your Aunt Betty and Uncle Barney?
Certainly we can. What would you like to know?
Well, there's a couple of things. You know, some people may not be familiar with the story of Betty and Barney Hill. You want to just quickly run by it for us?
Sure. In a nutshell, on September 19, 1961, Betty and Barney were on a brief vacation. They were returning from Montreal. Betty was a social worker for the state of New Hampshire and had a few days off. Barney worked for the post office. He was also actively involved in the civil rights movement, along with Betty, and in community affairs. So they were well known in their community in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. They were driving from Montreal back to Portsmouth through the White Mountains of New Hampshire when Betty spotted what she thought at first might have been a falling star or a satellite, but it perplexed her because it was falling upward. Well, she started to watch it in the sky as it grew over time larger and larger, and this perplexed her. And it seemed to have characteristics that were unlike anything she had ever seen before. She finally asked Barney to stop the car so that she could get a better look at it, and she did through binoculars as it passed over the face of the moon. And then Barney took the binoculars and watched it as it moved toward Vermont and then rapidly descended in his direction. It was silent, it was hovering, it was large, it had unconventional lighting. They returned to the car and headed south. They stopped again in an area called Franconia Notch, and this craft came lower and lower in the sky. They returned to the car, and it seemed to continue to pace them. When they were in Franconia Notch, they compared it to the size of the profile of the Old Man of the Mountain. The Old Man's profile was 48 feet, and this craft was nearly twice as large as the Old Man's profile. It continued to pace their vehicle, moving in a stair-step pattern, bouncing back and forth in the sky, and behaving very strangely. It seemed to be flashing as if it were rotating, flashing lights. And so they departed from Franconia Notch to an area called Indian Head. This was the area where the motels and hotels started and the wilderness ended. And Barney was very relieved. He thought he'd pull over again to get a better look because Betty was becoming more and more excited, and he said that really Betty rarely became excited. But before he could even pull over, this craft shifted ahead of them and stopped in the sky and descended rapidly in their direction, so that it was then hovering only 100 feet above them. And Barney stopped the car directly in the middle of the road to avoid being directly under it, and got out. He had the binoculars and he had a pistol he had taken from the trunk of the car. And he looked up at the craft. Betty did as well. They could see a double row of lighted rectangular windows on a disc-shaped craft. On this forward edge, there was a bright, intense blue-white light shining through, and then the craft shifted to an adjacent field, and Barney followed it into the field while Betty remained in the car looking up and down the highway. She knew she'd have to move the car if a car approached. Well, Barney stood in the field looking at the craft through binoculars, and he had full conscious recall of observing 8 to 11 figures looking down at him. And he told Walter Webb in his interview only a month later that these figures were strangely non-human. They were dressed in shiny, black, tight-fitting uniforms, and there was one at the window who held a special interest to Barney, and it seemed to be very interested in Barney. Barney became very frightened by this one and attempted to break away because he was losing his ability to take self-initiated action as he stared at this, and it seemed to impart some kind of message to him. And Barney was afraid he was going to be captured. Something started to drop down out of the bottom of the craft when the rest of the crew went to the back wall on the corridor that circled around this craft. And Barney was terribly frightened at this point. He was able to break away. He ran back to the car, and the craft shifted again. And now it was over the top of his car. As he sped down Route 3, which was the major north-south route through New Hampshire at that time, he began to hear a series of what he called buzzing sounds on the trunk of the vehicle. Betty called them beeping sounds. They were hearing the same thing. It was a bright, moonlit night. The stars were shining. Betty looked up above. All she could see is blackness. That tells me that the craft was probably directly over the car. And those beeping or buzzing sounds caused the car to vibrate and caused a tingling sensation to pass through Betty's and Barney's bodies. They stopped talking to each other. They lost track of where they were. The next thing they knew, they were 35 miles south. And there was another series of beeping or buzzing sounds, and they returned to full consciousness. They consciously recalled observing a fiery orb in the road. They consciously recalled encountering a roadblock somewhere along the road, but they didn't know where or when. They continued to drive south looking for this craft, but they didn't see it again. When they arrived home in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, it was at least 2 hours later than they had anticipated arriving. And there was physical evidence that something strange had happened. There was a 2-inch tear in the stitching along the top of the right side of Betty's dress and an 1-inch tear in the thick zipper fabric on the other side. And did you have a question or a comment? I'm sorry, I heard you, your voice.
No, but what I do want to do is give this story some legs, because in the 1960s, black and white couples were very uncommon. And for them to actually disclose something like this happened, I mean, first of all, you know, you want to stay back in the 60s, you want to stay away from, you know, having, because you're already under pressure from your peers. So, you know, for them to break the story out and being of a black and white couple, that gives this story a lot of legs.
Well, let me say, first of all, that they had intended for this story to remain confidential. They had everything to lose by having this story come out, because Barney had been appointed by the governor of New Hampshire to serve on the state advisory committee to the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. He was a delegate in Lyndon Johnson's administration. We, the three of us, were invited by Lyndon Johnson to attend his inauguration because of Barney's civil rights activities and his political activities in the state of New Hampshire. He was well known and highly respected in the state. And there were some other interracial couples in Portsmouth. I just wanted to add that.
Absolutely.
It was through a violation of confidentiality that this story was made public. But then, after it was made public in a Boston newspaper, Betty and Barney decided to disclose the truth.
We've left out the abduction part of the story so far, you understand. That's the highlight for some people anyway, right, Kathy?
Well, for
sure,
some
after her dreams, right?
Pardon me?
It was the dreams that actually brought everything into fruition, right?
Well, no, not really. Betty did have a series of 5 dreams, 5 nights. They started about 10 days after their close encounter with the UFO. But I think it was the physical evidence that really bothered them, those shiny spots on the trunk of the car that caused a compass needle to spin and spin, the fact that the tops of Barney's shoes were deeply scraped, he could only wear them for yard work after that, no logical explanation for how that happened, the fact that Betty's dress was badly torn and a pink powdery substance appeared on her dress after she folded it and put it in her closet, the fact that their watches that were in fine operating condition never worked again after that night. There were real concerns that something had happened. Now, maybe sure. those concerns brought on those series of dreams or nightmares that Betty had and recorded. Barney had not really heard much of the information in Betty's dreams and said that they were only dreams and that she should ignore them. However, Betty's supervisor at the welfare office suggested to Betty that perhaps the experience had distressed her so much that she was working them out in these dreams and nightmares, and perhaps they in some way reflected reality. So that is the truth about that part of the story. Now, the speculation by Dr. Simon and skeptics and myself when I was doing the research on this case was that perhaps Barney had somehow absorbed the information in Betty's dreams and that he had, under hypnosis with renowned psychiatrist Dr. Simon, over a period of 6 months where Dr. Simon imposed amnesia at the end of each session, Betty and Barney were in separate soundproof rooms so that there was no way that they could share this information. They couldn't overhear it. They couldn't remember what they said. The speculation was that maybe Barney repeated Betty's dreams and that Betty herself repeated her dreams. Well,
what?
Yeah.
I did a comparative analysis of Betty's and Barney's statements under hypnosis, separate hypnosis, and I have found evidence that this was a real event.
Sure.
Okay, we
need to take a break now.
Okay.
I want to get your commercial on there. So we'll be back in 3 minutes.
Okay.
Our guest today, Mr. Stanton Friedman and Ms. Kathleen Martin, authors of Science Was Wrong and Captured, The Barney and Betty Hill Experience. With Captured, this book clearly illustrates a well-researched investigation into who the Hills were and what they experienced. Never before have I seen such an in-depth analysis of such a controversial abduction case. I recommend this book to anyone who's interested in the alien abduction phenomenon or UFOs in general. And if anyone has doubts about what the Hills witnessed and what was done to them aboard an extraterrestrial spacecraft, should easily be forgotten after reading Captured. Science Was Wrong. Startling truths about cures, theories, and inventions they declared impossible. Over the centuries, there have been many errors in judgment made by scientists and engineers, some involving apparent discoveries that were simply wrong, some involving important discoveries that were simply ignored. Eventually, hard reproducible experimental evidence becomes so overwhelming that the truth or fallacy of the matter became clear and formal. Recognize. Several books have been written about such matters. This is one.
The few topics discussed here are aviation, space exploration, cold fusion, climate change. Science Was Wrong reminds you to ask questions and that it is okay to need further information before making important choices in our lives. Both books can be purchased by clicking on the links at our website, www.outoftouchradio.com. You can also purchase the books at our guest website, which is www.stantonfriedman.com or www.kathleen-marden.com. All right. Remember, visit their website, purchase the books, Captured, and Science Was Wrong. Okay. Stanton?
Yep.
Okay.
We
what are your thoughts?
Go on.
Sorry. No. Let's finish that story about Betty and Barney Hill.
Yeah, I think Kathy was going to talk more about Dr. Simon, who did the hypnosis work. And the only reason they wound up going to him was that Barney developed ulcers. He couldn't go to work anymore. Everything seemed to date back to this traumatic experience. He didn't know what it was, but, you know, what had happened during the missing time. So he was seeing a psychiatrist who said, "I can't help you, Barney. Let's get you to somebody who may be able to do you some good." And that's how they got to Dr. Simon. And as Kathy will tell you, Dr. Simon was unique in the world. He probably knew more about helping people work through post-traumatic stress disorder. They didn't call it that then. It was shell shock war veterans. He headed a hospital that had 3,000 beds. A lot of guys came back from World War II with troubles. And the Army even made a movie, Let There Be Light, in which he starred, showing how we used his techniques to restore people to a reasonable life. So they were very lucky. He didn't know a darn thing about flying saucers. But
right.
He was good at what he was doing, wasn't he, Kathy?
Yes, he was an excellent psychiatrist, excellent at regression, hypnotic regression.
And
to resolve.
Also,
go ahead.
He made sure that he was looking out for the two of them separately now. All the sessions were separate. And
sure.
One for each had to be stopped because he wasn't sure they could handle the terror that they were reliving. And he made a statement that their terror was as great as that he had seen in any of those war veterans. And he had
wow.
seen a lot.
So they had outbursts, huh?
Well, yeah. Look, you're relieving. Remember, there was no model for this experience. They couldn't say, "Oh, this is what Joe Jones had happened to him last year."
Right.
Nobody had reported
right.
such a thing. So while it's going on and they're reliving it, my goodness, are we going to get back? What are they going to do to us? What's going on here? That would be terror. You've got strange beings in a strange craft out in the middle of nowhere. There's no help coming. This happened at night, and it's pretty desolate up there in September. And so, you know, you can imagine the fearfulness of what is going to happen. And they were kept in separate rooms on board the craft, so there was no solace. I mean, the one interaction was that funny little bit of one of the crew members coming in and checking Betty's teeth, and he couldn't understand why Barney's teeth
right.
came out and hers didn't.
Yeah.
It's not the kind of story
yeah,
you expect anybody
that.
To make up. But Kathy, go on with from there. She did the checking on whether what came out matched when the two were together and was different when they were apart. That's a very important thing that nobody else had ever done.
Yes, and what I did is I had to take the periods of time when Betty and Barney were together. For example, when they were abducted, at the actual capture, I had to compare the information in Betty's dreams to the information stated separately by Betty and Barney. For example, in Betty's dreams, she stated that there were 8 to 11 men in the road and that they surrounded the car while Betty sat and Barney sat quietly and didn't speak to each other and they did not move. Well, Betty and Barney separately stated that there were men in the road who divided into two groups of three and that those three went to each door. Totally different from Betty's dream. And when this was happening, Betty and Barney were talking to each other. Barney said, "I think it's them." Well, first of all, they were wondering what it was. Was it a was there an accident ahead? Were they being robbed? Was this a roadblock? What was going on? And then Barney said, "I think it's them. I think it's the ones I saw in the field." And at that point, Betty became terrified. She opened the car door. She was going to flee into the woods, but they arrived at the door just as she was ready to open it. So she couldn't get away. They pointed something at her, and she became unconscious at that point. That's not part of the dream, but that was in the hypnosis session. So their statements were exactly the same about what happened, but they had no way of communicating that information to each other. And it was very different from what was in her dream material. And as you read the book, you'll find more examples of how this information differed from the information in Betty's dream material. And another point of science that Stan was very much involved with was the star map. Would you like to hear Stan tell about that?
Yeah, Stan, please. Can you give us the story about the star map, Marjorie Fisk?
Yeah, you have to understand that Betty knew who she was. Ancestors go back to the 1600s coming to the country. She was at home almost anywhere. So they finish their examination of her. She and Barney are in separate rooms. And she turns to one of the people, the beings, and asks them where they're from. "I know you're not from around here," the understatement of the month. So the leader of this crew shows her, he walks over, shows her what I can only presume was a holograph. A three-dimensional model, in quotes, with about 16 or 20 points of light connected with three different kinds of lines, trade routes, occasional expeditions, frequent expeditions. And she's looking at this model, map, whatever it was, 3 feet by 2 feet by 2 feet. So Betty is short, and she's looking right at this thing. And she says, "Well, where are you on the map?" Wise guy alien says, "Do you know where you are on the map?" "No, I don't know anything about astronomy." "Well, how can I tell you where I'm from if you don't know where you're at?" And you can imagine.
Carry on.
You can imagine Dr. Simon listening to this. What in the world is he getting into here? This is under hypnosis that she's going through this. So he asks her if she can remember what the map looks like. She says yes. He gives her a post-hypnotic suggestion. If and only if she can remember it accurately, please draw it later on. And so she goes home, and she draws it at home and brings it in a couple of weeks later and sort of forgets about it. Now, the map is in the book, The Interrupted Journey, and that was based not on all the tapes. Kathy has transcribed all the hypnosis tapes, which is kind of important. And the map is in there, and you say, what does it mean? Here are these points of light, stars, big deal. Which star is which? I mean, the galaxy's only got 100 billion stars, you know. So a woman named Marjorie Fish, who lived in Ohio as a school teacher, got a degree from Gettysburg College in Pennsylvania, And she read the book, and she was dubious. She couldn't imagine that aliens could look anything like us. But she actually visited Betty to find out more about the map because she figured there was something she could do. She went back and built three-dimensional models of our local neighborhood. Not one or two, but more like 26. And trying to find a three-dimensional pattern that would match the two-dimensional one that Betty had drawn. And she thought she'd get a lot of matches. She didn't get any. And then she started eliminating various stars. There were books that said what kind of stars should probably have planets in life. So she went by them. She didn't make up any of this stuff. And she started weeding out. And the difficulty here, I mean, you know, it's different. This is 2010. We're talking the late 60s. The difficulty here is the distance data. The astronomers weren't going anywhere, so there were very few accurate measures of the distance to nearby stars. You'd pick up five catalogs, you get five different distances for the same star. Now, if you're going to build a three-dimensional model, you better know the distances, you know, so you could look at it from all different directions and see if anything matched what Betty had drawn. So finally, when she got a new Gliese catalog of nearby stars, she built a model that only had about a little over a dozen, less than two dozen stars in it. And wow, there was a pattern that matched. To say she was excited is an understatement. And she had told the Coral Lorenzen, the head of the Aerophenomena Research Organization, about her work and asked if there was some scientist who could help her. And Coral contacted me. So I was traveling a great deal lecturing, and I managed to be in Ohio, not far from where Marjorie lived, and visited her trailer and looked at her models and was very impressed. She'd sent me a bunch of stuff, too. And I arranged for her to bring one of her models over to an observatory in Chicago where Dr. J. Allen Hynek was settled and explain what he did. And we, at a meeting of the MUFON organization in Akron, Ohio, I helped her explain what she had done. She was much better at talking to astronomers than people who weren't astronomers, frankly.
Right.
And I published the first article in that old standby Saga magazine. Bobby Ann Slate, Gironda, and I, and she's no longer with us, published an article about her work. And then I convinced the editor of Astronomy Magazine at that time, Terence Dickinson, who was a Canadian, as it happens. He was working in the States at the time, but he's got the Order of Canada, Canada's finest astronomy writer, I think it's fair to say. And he looked at what I sent him, and he talked to her and a lot of other people, and he published an article in Astronomy Magazine, playing it straight, believe it or not. And it got more response than anything they'd ever published. It was incredible. And over the next year, they published about a letter a month or two letters from people commenting one way or another. And then they put together a 32-page booklet, The Zeta Reticuli Incident, because she had identified the base stars, which, as it turned out, were a remarkable pair of sun-like stars. Oh, there were several things. All the stars connected with lines were sun-like, even though that's only true of roughly 5% of the stars in the neighborhood. All the sun-like stars in this very well-defined region of space, all of it closer than 55 light years, all the sun-like stars are part of the map, and all the stars in the map are sun-like, and the chance of that being a coincidence when it's only 5% or so that qualify is, depending on who you listen to, 1 in 10,000 to 1 in a million. Being very conservative, I'd say, oh, it's only 1 in 10,000. Anyway, Zeta Reticuli, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli, it's the constellation of Reticulum, which means the net in Latin, I'm told. I don't speak Latin.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Reticulum means the net. That's the constellation in the southern sky. You can't see it from here. I mean, I'm probably further north than you are, but these two stars were special for several reasons. They're the closest to each other pair of sun-like stars. Now, our star, the Sun, is about 4.3 light years from the next star over. We're kind of isolated out here in the boondocks. These two stars from each other are only about an eighth of a light year apart. They're more than 30 times closer to each other than the sun is to the next star out over. You know, we're in the boondocks. They got next door neighbors. Secondly, each star is visible all day long from the other star, and you could directly observe planets once you develop the technology. And third, most intriguingly, those two stars are a cool billion years older than the sun. So the combination of being so close to another similar system and being so old strongly suggests that they've had plenty of time to and reason to develop interstellar travel. You got a neighbor to go to. You know, so it's right. A very exciting piece of work. And yes, there were criticisms, to say the least. There were nasty attacks, just as there have been on every aspect of the Hill case. Remember the four rules for debunkers. What the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them. Don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. If you can't attack the data, attack the people. It's easier. And do your research by proclamation. Investigation is too much trouble. We still hear some of the craziest explanations you can imagine. You heard Kathy say they saw this thing go in front of the moon. And so how come an explanation that's being put forth quite a bit is that it was Jupiter? Since when does Jupiter go between the Earth and the moon? You know,
right.
You know, and Kathy mentioned the size of the old man of the mountain, which fell in, incidentally, not too many years ago. It's 48 feet. This thing was almost twice as large as that. Now, how can you make that out of Jupiter out there, you know? And right. There are all kinds of sillinesses, to coin a word, that are put out about this case that are flat out wrong. And you read them and you say, where'd they get that nonsense? There was a television show. What was the name of that, Kathy?
Cosmos. Carl Sagan's television show, Cosmos, depicted Betty and Barney driving down the highway in torrential downpours. Betty was turning the knob on a very staticky radio as she was nervously looking up at a light above the car. All of that is false. It was a bright starlit night. The moon was a waxing gibbous moon. It was between two-thirds and three-quarters full. It wasn't raining. I have the report, and I wrote about it in the book. I have the report from the archival records from the Mount Washington weather station to prove it.
Did anyone bring that to his attention?
I tried. Carl and I were classmates for 3 years at the University of Chicago. And I sent a strong letter to the group that put on the show, because there used to be this notion of equal time doctrine, you know. If you take a position on something and your opponents are entitled to respond, and I didn't get anywhere with that. But there was another television show that some people said explains it all. The one where supposedly somebody was abducted, and I can't remember the name of the show. Kathy, help me out here. You know,
I don't know which one you're talking about, Stan.
Bobby Schaefer, they watched this program, and that's where the story came from. That's just
okay. You're talking about the Outer Limits, the Bolero Shield.
Oh, Outer Limits, okay.
And Martin Kottmeyer wrote that, and he's a Midwestern farmer, by the way, and he wrote an explanation for the alien being that Barney described on board the craft. He completely ignored the fact that Barney had described a lot of things about the beings on board the craft before hypnosis. He had conscious recollection for this, and it's in Walter Webb's report that he wrote in October of 1961. But Martin Kottmeyer insists that Barney had to have watched the Bolero Shield and that 12 days later he saw Dr. Simon. Dr. Simon hypnotized him, and that Barney described the person on the Bolero shield under hypnosis, this alien being. Now, if you look at the picture, and actually you can view the entire Bolero shield on YouTube. Just Google that on YouTube, and you'll find it. And make a comparison yourself. There's no similarity. Martin Kottmeyer does point out that the Bolero shield alien is gray, and the ones that Barney described were gray. However, the Bolero shield was aired in black and white. Of course it would look gray.
Sure.
You know,
hey, guys, I don't want to cut you off, but unfortunately we've only got 4 minutes remaining, and, you know, I want to thank you guys for coming again. But before you leave, you know, I want you to give your email, your web addresses again. And also I want to get both of your thoughts on Stephen Hawking, and I also want to give some information on where you guys are going to be next. But go ahead, please.
Okay. Let's see. Website, www.stantonfriedman.com. And Kathleen with a K, -Marden.com. And you can use PayPal or whatever. And you get our both signatures on those things. I will be speaking in Exeter, New Hampshire, of all places, on Labor Day weekend on the 4th. These are all on my website, incidentally. And after that, I'll be in Angel Fire, New Mexico. And then we'll be in Burlington, Wisconsin. If the flood that took out the airport didn't take out Burlington. And there are a number of other conferences listed on the website. So we will be busy. There's a great deal, I should stress now, that despite what you might hear from the nasty, noisy negativists, there's a great deal of interest in flying saucers. I'm interested in flying saucers. I'm not interested in UFOs. All flying saucer UFOs, very few UFOs are flying saucers. So I'm interested in the flying saucers. And there's a great deal of interest. We were just both in Roswell, New Mexico.
How did that go?
That went extremely well.
Very well.
A lot of people bought books. A lot of took our pictures. I was named to the Roswell UFO Hall of Fame, if you can believe.
All right.
I think, wasn't it 4,000 people, Stan, who went through the museum where we were doing our presentations that weekend?
7,000, according to
it was 7,000. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Quite a large crowd. I did want to mention that I'm going to be speaking in Pennsylvania in October as well. So, and that information is on my website. There's an entire list under events at the top that you can click on and see where I'm going to be speaking.
All right. Thanks again, guys, for joining us. This was probably one of our best shows, and I'd like to have you guys come again.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Good.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thanks for having me.
I hear the drums echoing tonight, and she hears only whispers of some quiet conversation. She's coming in.
Again, keep listening to our show, Cashel, the www.outoftouchradio.com.
I stopped an old man along the way.